for those looking to live outside the box of religious performance and inside the love of an awesome Father, this is The God Journey. Do you have to be a bit of a psychopath to be successful in the world? The answer to that question is pretty surprising. Of course, we're also going to have to ask, is success in the world the same thing as being fruitful in the kingdom? But stand by for that. Hi, I'm Wayne Jacobson. This is The God Journey. Maybe the last one of the year. We'll have to see. But I've got a desk full of stuff here. And I thought, you know what? I better get to some of that. 'Tis the season to be jolly. At least that's the festive nature at the end of December. A lot of people think that's Christmas stuff. And it is for them. And although I'm not a great Christmas guy, I love the fact that life slows down after the 25th or the 24th. Get lots of relaxed time with family and friends, and that part I'm looking forward to. But I'm jolly this morning because I just put the finishing touches on chapter 10 of the 19 chapters I'm trying to write for this little book, Finding Church. So very excited to get that done. It's coming together in a lovely way, and I'm really excited about how, when, where we share this. I've got it in front of some people who are reviewing it for me just to give me some feedback as to what we're communicating and how it's communicating, and we'll go from there. Now it's kind of torturous. Don't talk about that here. I'm sorry. I'm just a little bit excited about it. I also hold in my hands a copy of El Miama. I don't know if I'm even pronouncing that right. I can't read the book at all. It's He Loves Me in Spanish. The ebook's been out for a few days, and I haven't got a chance to really announce it on the website yet at Livestream. The printed copies arrived today, a bit of a surprise. This has been a project we've been working on for about a year to get it. There's a group in Spain translating it for Castilian Spanish, and we had someone go through it and Americanize the Spanish for those of us in the Western Hemisphere. Can't read it at all, but if those of you are looking for a printed copy or an ebook, they're now available. I'm also finishing up Engage. I've actually done the last Engage video, even though there's one more I'm going to do that'll slot in at 23. The last one will be 24. Just little coaching, 5 to 7 minute, encouraging people to live inside a relationship. Love what people have been saying about them, how it's encouraged their journey. You can find those over at lifestream.org. And now, let's take a look at some email. We've got a bunch here from folks from the last couple of podcasts. Let's start with Sue, and this is from the last one about virtual relationships, and it's one of many that kind of focused on the same thing. So I'm also very sad after the podcast. The discussion was great. Where my feelings of sadness came in light of how broken and pained this whole relating thing has become. I'm learning that although I am in the desert, someday all of my our tears will be wiped away. It seems that right now Jesus is inviting me to rest more deeply in Him through this difficult curriculum He's inviting me into. If He's the resource itself as well as the supplier of all our needs, then there are riches in Him that are available nowhere else. I pray that He bless your heart richly. And that was in response to people who hear about relationships, who hear about people connecting, feel like that's not happening for them, and can't find people, can't find group, can't find friends that are on a similar journey. And unfortunately, because they've been part of religious groups for so long, the only people they know are religious, and those people kind of push you out of your life when you're no longer coming down to the song and dance. So they feel pretty marginalized there. They feel alone. Some talk about, you know, God's got me in this season. And hey, if you're in the season, relax into Him. This is not about sadness. When I talk about relationships, the connections God's doing in the world, Finding Church, the book I'm finishing up, I'm really encouraging people to look up. God's a God that connects people. It may not happen for you yet. There may be a season God may want you all to Himself, but that's not a lonely, sad season. That's a good season. And then when God invites us into loving others and connecting people, and there's a bit of initiative that takes to connecting. You know, people are going to sit home a lot and just go to work and do chores and watch TV or listen to their computer media, whatever. They're not going to drop in out of the blue. And I think after the first year, we're going to do a podcast called Finding Friends. We're going to talk about some of the things we can do as God might lead us to. But when I talk about God connecting people and the greater gathering and Jesus bringing the church together in the world, that's something He's doing. It's a lovely thing. If it's not happening for you yet, find your rest in Him. I like that Sue's doing that. Find your rest in Him. But be open to the fact, not sad that you don't have, but open to, God, how are you bringing people into my life? Who have you given me to love right now? And if I give one encouragement before we spend a lot more time talking about the road, I would say this, don't look for people of like-mindedness. Just look to love people around you. Just love people. Find the loneliest. Find the most marginalized people around your life. Might be neighbors, coworkers. Initiate, invite them to lunch, invite them over for dinner, and find out where do those relationships begin to connect and how do I love and how do people care about each other. And it doesn't have to all be about the God journey, and it can just be friendships. And out of those friendships, God does some marvelous things. So I'm sorry for those of you that feel sad and somehow are talking about the kinds of relationships God gives makes you feel like you're excluded from that. I would just say you're not. God's inviting you into that. And if the first step of that is, I want you to know me well enough that you're not going to gravitate to people to suck the life out of them that I want you to find in me, and that's a great period of time. That's not a bad deal. That's a good deal. And then as your heart gets freer, there's opportunities to find folks near us. This is a lonely world. I don't have to walk far down my street to find lonely people. Because everyone's so busy with their own life and all that stuff. There are people who are hungry for relationship. And because God made us for connection. And if you're feeling a desire for connection, what I just encourage you, don't let it make you sad. Let it open you to Jesus in a fresh way to say, who are you giving me right now to love? Who are you giving me to walk alongside? And it may even be some, you know, by posting on the blog, I know people often connect that way. And for a while, they're relationships that share this journey are virtual. There are people on the internet, but they can still be good and real and alive and incredibly stimulating. And then make the effort to meet face to face, even if you go across continents to get with people. God has ways. We'll talk more about that up the road in terms of how that connection can be felt, but let's leave it there for now because we could get lost on the whole podcast there. I just want to encourage you, though, that felt sad. Let hope rise in your heart and not the hope that, oh, I'm going to get disappointed again. Lose your expectations about what it has to look like, what that person has to look like to share a God journey. Lose that because I suspect there's people around you already wanting to be loved and God wants you to love, but for some reason they don't fit a profile you thought would be essential for fellowship. Most of the people I hang out with now don't fit my profile. God brought us together, connected us, and that's all been good stuff. So there's some maybe stuff to chew on until we get to it on the backside of the year. Marcellus wrote me this. This is from the podcast How It All Went Wrong, M.O. Bruner's book, and how the church went from being a community of souls to a corporation with a hierarchical system, how all that happened. He said, I found myself nodding, cheering, and near tears as I listened to the truths that you share in this podcast. I cannot explain how refreshing it is to know that I'm not insane, evil, or in rebellion concerning my views of what many of us call church. Now that I'm learning to walk solely in the love and trust of Jesus, I see so many things in a new light as the Holy Spirit continually speaks to my heart. I find it incredible how God will speak specific phrases to me in my quiet times with Him, only to have you say the exact same words as you speak from your own experience. I love that when my writings, podcasts, whatever, give people to recognize the language of the Spirit already in their lives and be able to put words to things, that's the best I get to do in the world. I love that. I love that that happens. And I love the fact that people who for a long time have felt judged, you're only outside it because you're hurt, you're bitter. I mean, just all the accusations, rebellious, and to really find out there's something growing in the hearts of people for which systemic Christianity doesn't answer the need. And to grow in that reality and watch what God does to build His church, connect His church in the world, that's a fun process. And we'll be talking more about it, I'm sure, in the year ahead, particularly as I get the book done and get to engage some of that conversation. Kim wrote this from the Where Conformity is King podcast, and that's just about groups that were so intensely legalistic that people really got devastated by it. She wrote this, I just read the comments from that podcast and I was in tears for two reasons. One, hearing the stories of abuse at the hands of religious entities. Oh, it must break the heart of God to see the damage done to people in His name. But also tears at the encouragement, sharing, and connection that is happening because you've provided a forum for the conversation. Impressed and appreciative beyond words. I love that. I love the fact that people are connected. We can have a forum that people can be honest and say, I got really shredded here, and there are levels of what pass off as ecclesiastical authority that are the opposite of what kind of authority Jesus gives his church, that they're destructive. Every conformity-based system will, in the long term, be destructive. I had a conversation with someone yesterday. Even the neat groups people start to get together, hungry for Jesus, they're going to start a church. Man, usually for 7 years or so, that can be a pretty good deal. That can be pretty exciting. And then over that time, we become increasingly a conformity-based system, and that conformity-based system will eventually start trading life for appearance, start trading freedom for conformity, and it can happen in very small ways. Obviously, when the community is king, we dealt with some incredibly strong elements of legalism that are that rise to the level of abuse, quite frankly. But any conformity system will, in time, feel like a straitjacket to you. I got this from John, and he describes a process that I think many of us have experienced and gone through, and I think he says it well, so I'm going to take a look at it. It says, when we last spoke, I worked at a megachurch. I've left the job since then, one of the best decisions I ever made, and after all, I was content just being in relationship with some folks I'd met on the journey in similar paths. However, my wife still felt very strongly that we needed to attend somewhere. Finally, we found a place that was very grace-centered, small group, family-oriented, and I felt like God was calling us there through some interesting circumstances. Well, we've now been there for almost 2 years, and though it started well, I feel religion bubbling back into the picture. The church was small, now it's growing in numbers, starting to feel shallow to me. It feels like we're slipping back into the same stuff. We have a huge focus on small groups, but the groups multiply after they get large, and we lose touch with folks we once had relationship with, and for some reason, it feels really hard to make that happen outside of it being programmed or scheduled. Break in here. A lot of people love that scheduled stuff. To really grow in relationships and actually communicate and have a growing friendship with people on this journey, that freaks people out. They want a meeting once a week, once a month, whatever, and they go to it. And even though going to meetings like that don't necessarily stimulate friendships, people come into a meeting, even have dinner together, but they're talking about Jesus stuff that they don't really know if they're living, and it feels awkward, but they do it because they need to. Then they go home, and they don't have any touch with each other outside of the meeting. None. And then they wonder why the friendships aren't growing. Friendships won't grow when you sit in a meeting with somebody. Friendships grow because you sit down to coffee with somebody, because you're in someone's home, because you're opening up your life, letting other people into your life. And so now we got groups and they're more systematized. And then it feels awkward because nobody wants to get together outside. And he says, continuing now with John's letter, and difficult to be real. I also kind of feel overwhelmed because there are so many people to connect with. I end up just not connecting with anyone because I like to go deep and would rather have a few close friends than many shallow acquaintances. And breaking in again, always a systemized stuff. Notice it's got us relating to everybody and the big group, and now the groups have to change and you change. And it really does reward shallow relationships and even sometimes impedes longer-term friendships, because everybody's worried about becoming a clique and everybody's worried about people feeling left out. And listen to this. Any good, healthy friendship will make room for other people. If you're my friend, I'm going to want you to know others of my friends. Any relationship, you know, it's just us 10. And we don't let anybody else come around anymore because we don't want anybody to ruin it. There's something suspicious to me about a friendship that is self-contained. That's not to say that there are people close to me that I want to be with just the two of us and share some stuff really deep. That's fine for that. But the relationships I have that I love, and you come around and say, man, I don't have any friends I'd love to, I'll introduce you to people I know. Because that connection that's a blessing to me, I want to be a blessing to you. Now, you're going to have to grow in that relationship yourself. You're going to have to engage the friendship, find the level of sharing. And that person and I may be together and share at a different level than when all three of us are together, because those relationships have to grow as well. But that's not, now we don't have time for that, because small group here has become a program. So he says, in addition, the feel of groups is changing. Leaders are trying to program our group time more to focus on the sermon, which is not all bad since we preach Bible and not topics, but it's feeling too intentional to me and not as authentic. Yeah, when you start going from becoming friends to discussing topics, that's part of the conformity octopus, that tentacles that start taking life and sucking it out because conformity and program become more important. Finally, he finishes that this is all rubbing me wrong, and I'm feeling like I used to once again about the institution. I feel like you do, that the more our church tries to make community happen, the more it will slip through our fingers. I hope that is what we've all learned. I was asked not long ago by someone, what did you do to most encourage community when you were a pastor? That's a great question. And I thought about it for a while because I couldn't come up with anything. I mean, we did small group stuff. We did it 15 different ways. We organized and reorganized it because there was a goal we wanted, but our systematic approach wouldn't get there. Relationships were happening among people. There's lots of good friendships, Jesus stuff going on, but not the way we were trying to manage them. And so I looked at the person and said, you know, the better question might be not, what did I do to encourage community? I think the better question would be, what did I do to make community more difficult by the desire to make it bigger and to do it ourselves to try and make it happen? We actually did things like this John's experiencing. That actually probably took away that kind of growth and help from other people. And that's a sad part of it, but it's there. Hey, a couple of things from the news that I just wanted to make some comment on. Alan Greenspan, the former Fed chairman here in the States, who presided over the collapse of 2008 and the whole resetting of our financial system because the greedy people at the top of the herd absolutely created a fraudulent economic system where things weren't worth what they were really worth. People knew it, and people drove it anyway. Still in America, you know, not one person has been held accountable. A couple of major firms now have been held accountable with some financial fines. But no one's been really accountable for the fact that there were people selling mortgages they knew couldn't be paid back. They were grouping those into derivative things that weren't worth what people said they were worth. And the day of reckoning came. And now the guy who was Fed chairman has a new book out, and he was interviewed recently. They are asking him, you know, what's the biggest change of your mind since 2008? And this is what he says. This is Alan Greenspan, former Fed chairman here in the States. He said it changed on September 15th. Most basic economics up to that point was based on the presumption that human beings are rational in that they will look out for their long-term self-interest. And his shock was that they didn't. That people took the money, all the money off the table they could. The big bonuses for Wall Street people, the bonuses for mortgage sellers at the local level, bringing people in that really weren't qualified, turning in false documentation because they were getting commission on things they were selling. And what his big shock was, people won't act. People wouldn't act in their long-term self-interest. What means they were looking for their short-term self-interest. Even if it was a lie, and even if a day of reckoning would come for other people, they were willing, and meaning our financial system, where the government bailed out, they walked away with all kinds of money. And I think this is what sin really is. You get to the heart of sin, it's simply this. I'm going to ignore my long-term interests for short-term pleasure, short-term gain, short-term whatever. That gets to the heart of sin. Because in God's love for us, He wants what's best for us. God wants for you what is in your long-term interests. You really understood the whole dynamics of the universe and God and life and spiritual, whatever. What God's inviting you into is in your maximum interest. It is the best thing in the world for you. The problem is we as humans can't see that. When we look at the next moment and the next thing we want, we've learned to grab for what we want because no one else is going to give it to you, and certainly God's not. And so we become people who live in our short-term self-interest. And what shocks me is that here's a guy whose livelihood, whose job depended on understanding the basics of human nature. And he defines rationality, which I love. Rationality is people doing things that are in their long-term best interest. And instead found out there was a whole system designed that wasn't meant to do that, that wouldn't reward that, that would reward short-term. And you know what? We still have that system. Nothing has really changed here in the States. For all the talk of government, the reality is our financial people own our system and own our politicians. And because of that, there's still no accountability. There's no desire to make in the name of liberty, there's no desire to make the playing ground legal and fair so that those who hold great power wield a disproportionate amount of control. And that control is not for the good of the culture they live in. It's actually good for themselves. Now, I don't want to take that on with a conversation that went on a few months ago between Miley Cyrus and Sinead O'Connor. Now, Miley Cyrus is a young pop singer, the old Hannah Montana, who's now got to push herself, and she's gotten a lot of fame for it. She dances incredibly provocatively, I mean, simulating sex on stage in some incredibly rancid ways. I guess I'll stay with that. And the dancing is called twerking. It's become so obnoxious, but she does it. She does it everywhere because why? It gets her a ton of press. And that press translates into sales, and it also changes her image from this goody-two-shoes Disney-based Hannah Montana to being cutting-edge shocker in the lights of Lady Gaga and previous generations, Madonna, and people like that. Sinead O'Connor, who I'm not a fan of musically, she's a very anti-religious person. She was raised Catholic, got really hurt in the Catholic thing, and incredibly angry over all the abuse that went on in the Catholic Church. Now the Catholic Church has still failed to own up to all that in a way that's responsible. So she's got some anti-religious stuff, but she wrote an open letter to Miley Cyrus. And I want to read to you part of it because I think this is an incredibly insightful letter. This was an open letter to Miley Cyrus by Sinead O'Connor, another singer. She says, "I am extremely concerned for you that those around you have led you to believe or encouraged you in your own belief that is in any way cool to be naked and licking sledgehammers in your videos. It is in fact the case that you will obscure your talent by allowing yourself to be pimped, whether it's the music business or yourself doing the pimping. Please, in the future, say no when you are asked to prostitute yourself. Your body is for you. It isn't for every dirtbag on the internet or every greedy record company executive to buy his mistress diamonds with. The message you keep sending is that it's somehow cool to be prostituted. It's so cool. Miley, that's dangerous. Women are to be valued for so much more than their sexuality. We aren't merely objects of desire. I would be encouraging you to send healthier message to your peers that they and you are worth more than what's currently going on in your music career. That they and you are worth more than what is currently going on in your career." That's a pretty strong stuff. Dead on. I saw a recent interview by Sinead O'Connor. She was asked, "Was there a moment in your own life where you learned that the music business was not on your side?" And she says, "Every single day of your life. The music business is corrupt, a spiritually corrupt arena. It's full of nothing but vampires and pimps, honestly. You couldn't understand it unless you're in it." Now, the reason I'm focusing on this is not because Miley Cyrus is that significant or Sinead O'Connor, actually. But I think when I read stories like this, I think about what they undergird in our own human nature. It's not just book companies or music companies. You watch people who become, particularly young ladies, because that's where their sales force lies in our twisted world. And that is you pimp them up as much as you can. Watch American Idol. Watch any of the music contests. Girls come in off the street, pretty clean cut, excited about their career, whatever. Watch them over the course of the weeks of a show. As the higher they get up in the deal, the more they start to lose who they really were, and the more they start tarting up or pimping up these girls because that's what will draw attention. You got to have talent behind it. No doubt there's got to be some talent behind it. But you take the talent, and to really distance you from other people who have talent, is that you've got to wear shorter, tighter, lower outfits. And that is what will cause people to catch their eye. It's what will cause people to buy your stuff. And that really inures to the benefit, yes, to the talent themselves. Certainly, they will get bigger contracts, whatever. That really, and I like what Sinead O'Connor here, she's really pointing to a different group. It's not the artists that are corrupting things so much. It's the producers behind the artists, who have one thing in mind. We're going to make as much money from you as long as we can make that money from you. And then we're going to ditch you. Whenever your arc moves downward, believe me, we're going to toss you aside and we're going to find the next big thing. We're going to tart that up as much as we can. And then we're going to see what we can do with that. I heard this said of an industry executive in the publishing industry. And he said, "People think we're in the business of selling books." He says, "We're not. We are in the business of creating monsters because monsters sell books." You've got to pump up someone's ego, pump up someone's sense of themselves that's highly inflated. In fact, one of them said, we don't have the example of someone who goes from obscurity to national prominence who doesn't become a self-possessed monster. Now, listen to that. And the industry doesn't mind creating it, whether it's music, books, any artistic thing. We don't mind propping you up and putting you out there. And there's three players in this process. There's the controller, where it's producers, publishers, music, or otherwise. There's the controller. There's the force behind it. They make the most money out of this thing. They find somebody with talent, and immediately, as soon as they find that talent, they're changing that talent into a commodity and changing the person into a commodity. And they're willing to do just about anything with that person that will increase sales revenue. And you don't have to spike it a whole lot. Anything that tarts it up, anything that makes your ego float, that makes you think a big deal, and the more you think of yourself a big deal, the better commodity you'll be in the world. And the more, now here's the last one in the group, is the consumer. It's people who buy the records, buy the books, buy the stuff, and follow the personality stuff and all the People magazines and all what we do to celebrities. The celebrities pay the price. Oh, they get paid ridiculous amounts of money, certainly. But they lose all their sense of personal privacy, and well, they should for the money they're making. But they lose all sense of privacy. The people who really make the most money, it's not talent. It's producers behind talent. They make the money, use the celebrity as a commodity, as long as they're usable. Toss them aside at the end of the day, done with you, we're going to find somebody else. That's the smallest percentage of people. That whole system works because of the consumers. 99% of the rest of us who buy that stuff, who glory in the celebrity stuff, who want to see these people who are just a shell of what they are in public is not who they are in private. And we adulate that and we think that's what it is to be successful. Now I'm going to get to the psychopath question, which we started the whole thing with. I heard about this book. The book's called The Wisdom of Psychopaths, What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success. And I heard about this on a podcast, a news podcast I listened to. So I haven't bought the book. I haven't read it. I listened to them talk to him about it over about a 20-minute span. He's got a website. I'll give it Kevin Dutton, kevindutton.cu.uk. He's an author from England, and he's done some research into psychopaths. And what they found was there's something valuable in a psychopathic personality. Now, I know we think of psychopaths as people who will do anything. They have no sense of the consequences to human society. They often kill animals when they're little children for the sheer delight of it, because they have no empathy. They have nothing that is invested in other living things around them. So they can rape, kill, murder. They can do that stuff without any sense of feeling bad for the victim. That's what psychopathy is. But he defined psychopath as, he said that it's a whole spectrum. It's not that the extreme ends, we know, the criminal element in psychopaths. But he talks about the positiveness and the subtitle, The Wisdom of Psychopath, What Saints, Spies, and Serial Killers Can Teach Us About Success. And he's got a little 10-12 point test. I don't remember it. He gave it on the air. So I listened to it and took it. Sarah and I scored low on the psychopathy scale, which means we won't be successful as far as the world's concerned, which is fine with me. Questions like, is it okay to ignore a commitment if something better comes along? That puts you up the scale if you agree with that statement. Doesn't matter if I step on people to get what I want. That puts you up the scale. If I con someone, it's their problem. They deserve it. In other words, I don't care about how I exploit people. If they're dumb enough to be exploited, then that's their problem, not mine for exploiting. And that's where con artists come from, the whole thing. And then this cheating on your spouse is okay if you don't get caught. Now, that's four of a number. You can go to the website and look at them all if you want to. When I read this and listen to it, what was most coming out here, I'm going to play you part of it, because here is the conclusion that he reached that maybe touches the God Journey audience the most.
A couple of years ago, I conducted a survey over here in the UK called the Great British Psychopath Survey. And there was a top 10 list of psychopathic professions over here in the UK. Number one, perhaps not surprisingly, as you just said, CEOs were up there. Lawyers, barristers were up there as well. Surgeons, we've already covered those, were up here. But one of the really surprising things, well, surprised me at the time, but not actually when I look back on it and discussed it with my colleagues, was clergy people were also in the top 10, people who worked in the church. And as I say, this surprised us at the time. But when you think about it, what you find is that people who are high on the psychopathic spectrum do very well in professions where there is a power dynamic, where there's an organizational hierarchy, where they can wield control and influence over others. And to put it crudely, the church in that respect is no different to any other profession.
No different than any other profession. That ought to tell you everything you need to know about our human ways of doing church. They're just like every other organization in town, which must tell us at some point, this may not be the church Jesus is building, which is why our hearts hunger for something else. It all holds the same thing. Hierarchical systems, control, the better CEOs, which you talked about earlier, the better producers that we've talked about, the control people, it helps you to be a bit of a psychopath, to not care about people and what you might be doing to them to advance whatever personal agenda, vision that you have. And I do think that fits right into all we've talked about, this religious stuff. What's gone wrong with the whole religion thing as part of it? How it gets to the place of conformity being king and the people at the top actually treating people in abusive ways and not seeing it because they have no empathy for the people they're doing it to. They don't have a gene in there that said, man, I feel bad. This is, if I was on the other end of this thing, the whole golden rule Jesus taught us, do unto others what you would have them do unto you. That's a powerful, powerful reality. I know you learned it in Sunday school, so it's cute. What it just says, I'm not willing to treat you in any way differently than I would want you to treat me. Psychopaths have no such gene. They have no such empathy. And what's bothered me about this, this helped crystallize some thinking for me, because one of the things I talk about learning to live loved and learning to live in the life of God is that you are less aware of what other people are thinking of you. You don't look for man's approval anymore or woman's approval. You're not so worried about appearances. When you know you're loved by God, you don't have to play the games our world plays in terms of caring what other people think. And I've said often, I think the greatest freedom God's brought into my life is the freedom from the tyranny of other men's opinions from us, especially when they seek to control us. But that's a great freedom, is not to be concerned or aware. But every time I talk about that, I'm aware this approaches what a psychopath is, because a psychopath doesn't care. Judge me all you want. I'm disconnected from your judgment. And I know that's not right. But I listen to this discussion about psychopaths, I came away saying, you know what? There really is a freedom in Jesus. And Scripture talks about it extensively. Jesus says to the Pharisees, you can't understand truth because you care what men think about you. And he says, I only care what God thinks. He said, the person who cares about that will find truth. People who only care about what others think of them. And that's illustrated at one point when the Pharisees come to Jesus and say, by what authority are you doing the things that you're doing? And Jesus, knowing they were up to trapping him, and, you know, if he said from God, then, you know, is it from God or from men? Well, obviously, Jesus didn't have any authority from men. He wasn't a religious leader. He wasn't a political leader. He wasn't a businessman. He didn't have any of the normal conventions of power. And yet, one of the things that's talked about in the Gospels extensively is how much authority Jesus had. And that's what threatened the Pharisees, his authority. He had authority of people. And it wasn't the authority of humanized power. It was the authority of an indestructible life. It was the authenticity of a man who spoke and lived truth in the context of love. And that completely overturns the power structures of our day. And so when the Pharisees come to him and say, where are you getting your authority? Jesus said, well, I'm going to ask you a question. You tell me where John the Baptist's authority, where did he get it? Was that from man or from God? And the Pharisees do not know how to answer. I mean, they've got their opinion, absolutely. But whatever they can say, if he says it's from God, then the people are going to say, so why haven't you followed him? And if they say it's from man, they're worried that the people are going to kill him because the people regarded John as a gift from God. And so what they end up saying is, we can't answer the question. And she says, I won't answer yours. The point is this, if you care about what other people think of you, you'll never find the truth. Because you're making true whatever ingratiates you to the people you want to be ingratiated with. And I've said it, one of the greatest freedoms I have that I did not have 20 years ago is that I'm not, even in a room full of people, I'm not vested in their opinion of me. But what keeps that from not being psychopathic? And that's the other side of it. Just say, I do care what God thinks. And when you care what God thinks and you know that you're loved, I think what that produces, in all honesty, and it's not just the theology of love, but it's actually being loved, is that you have an empathetic heart for other people. You won't do to them what you wouldn't want them to do to you. You just wouldn't. It's not like, well, I could, but I'm going to choose not to because the golden rule says. The golden rule becomes a reality in the context of love. And it's, I may not care about what you think of me, but empathy in my heart says I care about you as a person. So I'm not going to do to you some of these things that make you a psychopath. And in the words of Kevin Dutton, who wrote the book, there's some value to this. The world rewards people who can exploit others without a conscience. The world, if you want to be a successful CEO, you've got to do that. You've got to make the hard choices to cut people out, to do what's best for the bottom line of the company without regard to any of the humans you're impacting in the process. That makes you a better leader. Also this week, we've been celebrating Nelson Mandela's life. I did a blog on it, ticked some people off, not many. I think most people realize this man came out of prison an incredibly transformed person. He wasn't perfect. I don't know that he's the deepest Jesus follower on the planet. Some say he came to Christ in prison. I don't know that. I read his book. I loved it. I love that he came out of that thing. And what ticks me off about his celebration service this week is you got all the world leaders coming there to bask in the Mandela aura when not one of them understand what it is. Not one of them understand what it is to talk to your enemies. To realize we have a responsibility, not just to my crowd and get power for them, but to share power across the board. He came out of prison knowing that he had to liberate both the oppressed, which were the black people of South Africa, but also had to liberate the oppressors, the white folks who had been the captors for so long. I think the brilliance of that, what he learned in prison about that was incredible. Well, Thomas Friedman article the other day, this is from New York Times, told you I had a lot of news stuff laying around my desk here. That there's some wonderful things going on in the world that lets you have some insight about stuff that God's doing, even if they're not God people talking about it. The column was Mandela Unique from New York Times writer, columnist Thomas Friedman. And he's actually quoting Dov Seidman, who's got a company who advises CEOs on governance and is the author of the book How, H-O-W. I've not read the book. I don't know anything about the author. But here's what he said about Mandela, and this goes to a lot of what we've been talking about on the God journey, and a lot of what our political leaders didn't understand who were at his funeral or memorial service, and a lot of what religious leaders back home don't understand as well. And he said this, people are rejecting leaders who rule by the formal authority of their position and command by hierarchical power. Listen to that. That's been going on for a few thousand years. People are rejecting that. And he says what they're craving is genuine leadership, leaders who lead by their moral authority to inspire, to elevate others, and to enlist us in a shared journey, not my side over your side, because psychopaths are more successful in a world system. If you want to be successful in a world system, then a bit of psychopathy is important. Now, you don't want to go to the clear extreme where you're killing people. But you can gossip about them, you can lie about them, you can lay them off when you find a better, cheaper thing overseas, split up the company, do whatever is in your economic short-term self-interest. That's, we get back to Milton Friedman's article now. And watch what happens as people get destroyed. Or you can be a person who's learning to live inside the love of the Father. That's one, it's going to make you a little bit, not a little bit, a lot less aware of how other people judge you. At the same time, it's going to make you a more empathetic person for what others are going through. And I love that balance. To me, I see that in Jesus so clearly. He didn't worry about the judgment of the Pharisees. When he gets to Pilate, he doesn't worry about Pilate's judgment against him. He won't even defend himself because he knows, I guess, I would assume he didn't defend himself because he knows he wins the argument. If he's going to defend himself, he's not going to get to the cross, and the cross is what he needs to get to for a larger thing to happen for the rest of us. But he had both the, I don't care what you think of me, but I care about you as a person. And I'm going to love you in a way that helps you find freedom. And there's the balance between not caring what you think, but not losing my heart for you as a person. And I will care about what you are, and I'll care about you. And I'm therefore not going to do the kinds of things that deceive and lie and hurt and lead from authority and push people toward whatever. It's a great freedom. And I hope it's one coming more and more alive in your life as well. Hope you have a happy new year, blessed holiday season. Probably see you on the other side in 2014.
Thank you for traveling with us on The God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.